Let's make today the day you get one step closer to becoming the parent you've always wanted to be and the parent your children deserve. Hi, and welcome to Powerful Parenting for Today's Kids. I am your host, Erin Taylor, and I have wanted to help parents and children literally since I was 11 years old. I created this podcast to help you make a stronger, healthier, deeper connection to your child, to understand the inevitable challenges a little better, and learn some new ways to navigate them when they occur. Thank you for spending some time with me. Now let's get this show started. Hello and welcome back to the show. This is episode 624, and I'm really happy to have with me here today Dr. Janine Janot. Dr. Janot has more than 25 years of experience working with children, teenagers, and young adults in both public and private school settings, spanning preschool through college. She holds a master's degree in school psychology from The Ohio State University and a doctorate in child and developmental psychology from the University of Connecticut. Since 2010, she has been a college instructor teaching psychology courses and freshman seminars. Today, with escalating numbers of students failing their virtual classes during the pandemic, disintegrating students have become a nationwide crisis. And Dr. Janot has written a book called The Disintegrating Student, Struggling But Smart and Falling Apart, and How to Turn It Around. Welcome, Janine. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Erin, for having me.
So we're going to talk about disintegrating students today. Boy, yes. What a topic, right?
We all know them and love them, right?
Absolutely. I'll say that I have noticed with the clients that I work with that more and more, even earlier, even more significant than in the beginning of the pandemic, more are coming to me now struggling with pandemic-related impacts, negative impacts. It's way worse now than it was a year ago, even. Are you seeing that too?
I'm seeing the same things. It started second semester last year is when I really saw the bottom fall out as far as like motivation and kids not really caring. I mean, that was the first time my clients were coming to me and saying, I know I should care. I used to care, but I don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. So that was something. And then I think this year has been, it's been a whole different animal, but the struggle has been much more, I think, than we anticipated.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that kids are having a difficult transition back to school this year. You know, it's always a transition to switch from summer, relaxed, different pace, different schedule or no schedule to, oh my gosh, we have to get up at the same time every day, go to school, do my homework. But this transition from summer to school seems even harder because they had all that remote schooling, many of the kids.
It's almost as if, and I mean, this is an overstatement, but it's almost as if they forgot how to do school. And it's very unsettling.
And I know that I feel that with my kids, I think that the teachers were very, very lenient last year, all of last school year, certainly the couple of months at the end of the school year of 2020. But last year, I think they were very lenient, which was wonderful and needed because it was a weird way to right. go to school. But I think maybe we as parents, students, and teachers didn't anticipate the long-term ramifications of that leniency because now they're back in school and the expectations are closer to what we were used to seeing pre-pandemic. And they're not ready for it.
And even I would say, just in talking with my clients, it feels to me the message I'm getting from the students is, at least in their eyes, the expectations are even greater. So they went from almost, you know, like zero to 1,000, for, you know, and it was a shock to them. So again, I think it was very helpful and well-intentioned how we did school last year. It was just responding to the situation appropriately. But I think maybe there was just such a rush to get back to normal as much as possible and meet the demands of, you know, the achievement culture and get these kids back up to where they need to be, where we might have rushed that too much. And in doing so, we've shut down and paralyzed a lot of kids because they just aren't functioning at their best.
Right. And what one of the unfortunate things that I see in mass media is people seem to want to point the finger and blame. It's the teachers who are failing. It's making kids wear a mask or not making kids wear a mask or whatever, you know, policies, school board members, principals, this, that, and the other. But all of that is not helping to fix anything. It's just spreading negativity and blame around. And I think that you and I have a great opportunity to discuss not what went wrong or why or whose fault it is, but what do we do now? Because that's the reality, right? The kids are struggling. So how do we help them as parents and as teachers and as coaches and therapists? How do we help these kids who are struggling?
I mean, it's such a great question. And I really take your point about the blame issue, because I, you know, as a parent myself of three kids, there've been lots of times where I've been looking for somebody to blame for whatever, you know, situation or heartbreak or poor outcome that my child has had. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just kind of human nature. But the truth is, we are all very well-intentioned. All the stakeholders in education are well-intentioned. So the teachers, the administrators, the colleges, the parents, certainly, we're all well-intentioned. We don't wake up and think, how can we make our children miserable? That has not been our goal at all.
Or make them fail.
I mean, so I've tried to step back from that. And in the book, I try to really tease this all apart so that we kind of come to an understanding. Why are we doing this? Why is so much going wrong when it comes to our kids in school and their mental health? And what I've come to realize is it's the bigger issue of the achievement culture that we're educating our kids in. Mm. And a culture is something that surrounds us in a way, in an invisible way. So we don't always necessarily understand how it's impacting our thinking, our behavior, our assumptions. And I think that's where we need to understand the achievement culture that's been developing over the past 30 years has been one to say, it's the data that counts. Success is measured and data points. So it is what are your grades? What are your awards? What scores are you getting? How are you doing on the ACT, SAT? It's a lot of checking the box to get the next thing. And that has been the key driver. That's why educators are educating the way they are. That's why parents are parenting the way they are, because we were in a very high stakes, high pressure, achievement culture that isn't valuing things like curiosity and learning and resilience and making mistakes to learn. So I say that because I think as parents, one of the things we do have control over is sort of sitting down with our family and talking about, well, what is achievement to us? You know, let's look at this broader, you know, school situation you're in, but is that okay with us? Do you need to take, when you're in high school, do you need to take 8 APs? Do you need to be, you know, as a middle schooler, do you need to be on the advanced, you know, taking high school classes by the time you're in 7th and 8th grade? Is that going to be good for you? Regardless of whether you can, you know, academically handle it or not. I mean, that's one question. A lot of our kids, and most of the clients I see who are these high achieving kids, most of them can handle it. but it's too much on a broader scale. So there's a lot of baggage that comes with that. So I mm-hmm. think we have to sort of, as a family, we need to be talking with our kids and saying, you know, what are our expectations? What are our goals? And then there's a lot of things, and I don't know if you want to get into this, but there are a lot of things that we do as parents that is very well intentioned in response to this achievement culture, which is having really detrimental consequences for our kids in the long term. Things like helping. We help too much. We help when they don't need it. We help when they don't mm-hmm. want it. And there's a lot of, when we do that long term, what our kids come to understand is, well, I guess I can't handle it. And so our kids start to rely on us to handle all the things. So we're raising kind of young kids. So what we see now is, like, you know, 15-year-olds being more like 13-year-olds used to be, and 18-year-olds being more like 15-year-olds used to be. Mm-hmm. They're just being more protected and not getting those opportunities to learn from their mistakes, take appropriate risks, which is normal in adolescence, which kind of sets them up for potential failure as they leave our homes, you know, when they graduate high school to go do the next thing, whether it's college or a career. And so I think those are some of the things that we need to look at as parents, like, how are we parenting? How are we responding to that achievement culture?
I think that's a really, really good point. And it makes me think of a recent scenario with my own daughter, who is a junior in high school. She is the kind of kid who has always had a natural curiosity that thankfully wasn't too squashed out of her in going through her years of school. It was a little bit dampened, but not, it wasn't crushed like it was with my older son. But anyway, she just has had a natural love of learning. She just loves all of her classes, mostly her teachers. She'll come home and say, "Guess what we learned today?" And it's just such a breath of fresh air.
Yes, that's wonderful.
It is wonderful. I'm so thankful that she still has been able to protect that curiosity and that joy of learning. But we learned at the end of 10th grade that she is 21st in her class. And she had no idea, because she didn't even know that this was a thing to think about or look at or work towards or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a pleasant and interesting surprise. But I watched what it did to her. And it turned her focus onto, well, if I'm 21st, maybe I should break into the top 20. And what do I have to do to achieve that? And all these kinds of comments would come from her, more focused on her rank and her grades than, oh, guess what we just learned? She still did some of that. But anyway, she's having a really hard time in her math class right now. And she is just, like, you know, barely keeping her eyes above the water. And she's gotten help from my husband, who's great at math, from my son, who's great at math, from my brother-in-law, who's great at math. She's gone during the school period when she can go get help from her math teacher. I mean, we've looked up YouTube videos. She's been working really hard, and it hasn't significantly gotten easier. And she currently has a C in the class, and that's not going to move her into the top 20. In fact, it's going to, you know, drop her down. And so we've had really interesting conversations about, is a goal of yours to actually get into the top 20? Or is it just something that would be kind of cool since you're at 21? Does it really matter to you? Is it going to change the outcome of where you go to school? She has no interest in aiming for Ivy League schools or some uber competitive schools that would actually matter. Mm-hmm. She just wants to go to college. She has no idea what she wants to study. She's, you know, kind of not very solid, you know, solidified with any of that stuff. So in all of those conversations, she realized it actually doesn't really matter if she's 21st or 7th or 30th. It doesn't matter at the end of the day. But she weighed her options. I told her that she could drop the class this year and take it next year when she has a lighter course load. And she went in and talked to her guidance counselor. And after all of that, she came to the conclusion that she would. She said to me something interesting, and I'm sharing this deep story because I think it's valuable to the listeners, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. She said, after looking at the pros and cons, keep the class, drop the class, get the better grade, get the worst grade. What does it do? What does it mean? She said, I think that my future self would be more proud of me if I stuck it out and risked getting a worse grade than quitting now and taking it when times are easier. And I was just like, whew.
I love
that.
Your daughter.
Thank you. I do too. But I thought that was so wonderful because she came to that conclusion after we looked at all of the things. You could probably get an A if you put it off till next year. You might end up with a C if you keep doing it now, because she's in the middle of her volleyball season. She has very little free time to put extra work to math. But a different kid, a different set of parents, a different way that conversation goes, and she might be putting it off, which isn't necessarily a bad thing either.
But kudos to you for giving her the control to make that decision and having the conversations with her, and for not, you know, a lot of parents would, you know, really strongly suggest or make their child drop it, you know, to serve their GPA, to make sure their GPA wasn't dinged or class rank or whatever it is. Because again, they're being influenced by that high pressure, high stakes achievement culture says, do whatever you can to make sure you've got this best thing on paper. And your story illustrates so beautifully what so many students go through. And so she was on the, your daughter was sort of on the brink of letting her motivation become externalized, which means that she was starting to care more about what that class rank was saying about her than that love of learning, that I just want to show up and, you know, do my work and learn things and enjoy this. And what we know and what I see are kids who have fallen off. They've gone full, you know, hook, line, and sinker into the external, the grade, the score, the GPA, all those things is what they're working for. And their parents are right alongside them saying, yes, go, 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 as cheerleaders. And they hate it. These are the kids who are losing motivation. These are the kids who are not enjoying school. They do not have a love of learning. They're cheating a lot. And that got worse last year, of course, with virtual learning. But part of the cheating comes out of the achievement culture, where it's a means to an end, where these kids have so much to do. And again, it's high stakes. So if they can cheat on a homework assignment or a thing they're just getting a check on, They do it not only to make sure they're checking all the boxes, they do it, and it's kind of heartwarming, they actually are doing it to help each other because they see the stress other kids are under, either from themselves or from their parents, or they're, you know, in jeopardy of failing a class. And, you know, they're like, here, let me help you, which I think that's kind of awesome. I don't love that cheating is actually widely accepted and part of our kids' learning, quote unquote, learning experience. But that is the reality. It is widely accepted and widely practiced among our students, and probably will continue to be until we make some changes as to what we value in education and, you know, what we're determining or considering success in our kids.
Such a good point. Okay, so we just talked about kids and cheating. And as you were talking, I was thinking about why do kids cheat? And you kind of touched on it a little bit, you know, trying to get the grade, get the scholarship, get the acceptance, please their parents, check off the boxes. And you said it's kind of oddly touching when kids cheat because they're trying to help their friends who are also, they know they're also struggling with all of these things. And what it made me think of is fear. And I talk with parents all the time about how toxic fear is in our relationships with our kids. And I'm thinking about how fear is once again rearing its ugly head in this situation with kids in school and cheating and checking boxes and stuff. But in this case, I think it's fear on the part of the parents and the kids. Fear Absolutely. That they're not going to get into the school of their choice. Fear that they're not going to get the scholarship. Fear that they're not going to break the top 20 or be valedictorian or whatever it is. Fear, fear, fear. So what are you finding in your travels with families?
100% that. It is, in the book, I really go into a lot of the things that we do as parents that is well-intentioned. Because we love our kids, we want the best for them, we want them to be successful, but ultimately it is driven by fear and anxiety. And, you know, and then our kids are responding the same way. One of the things I see is that when a kid starts to disintegrate, that shows up as, you know, maybe not handing things in, they start to have a poor attitude about school, maybe they try to avoid school, the grades start to become inconsistent, and you maybe start dropping a little bit more. And usually the parent, you know, the first thing a parent will say is, hey, what's going on? And the kid will say, I don't know. And they're not lying. They really don't understand, because they've always been able to just kind of do what they do when they get good grades or well enough grades. And what ends up happening here is the parents and kids, there's miscommunication and misunderstanding that starts to happen here as to what's really driving all this. And the parents' narrative in their mind, the story they're telling themselves is, well, my kid doesn't care anymore. You know, they're just lazy. They're not motivated. And I've offered help. I've offered a tutor. I've offered to sit and help with them. I've offered to talk to the teacher, and they're not taking me up on that. So it's in their control. And a student in their head is thinking, my parents care more about my grades than they do me. I'm petrified to disappoint my parents. I think this is only happening to me, not my friends. And they really have a fear that they're no longer capable. They're no longer good students. They're not bright anymore. So you have, these are the things that are driving the fear in both of their heads, and they're mismatched. So it's a problem on top of a problem. Mm-hmm. And it is so critical that, you know, starting as young as possible, that you sit down as a parent and talk to your kid about expectations, making sure everybody's on the same page about expectations, being very reasonable, it's not a one, education is not a one size fits all. The mentality should not be, we've got to win at school. You cannot win at school. That's not a thing to do. So that honest communication where parents, especially as the kid gets older, can be very vulnerable and say, I'm just very stressed about this. And I worry that if you aren't this kind of student, you won't be able to go to this kind of college. But if we don't say those things out loud to each other, you know, maybe the kid doesn't want to go to that kind of college, but feels pressured and afraid to say that to the parent and feels like they have to do all these things. And if they don't, they're going to be disappointed in the parent. Again, if there's these stories that don't match up, that's not great for a parent-child relationship, which are already challenging enough as, kids hit those, 10 years and up. It's a roller coaster. So one of the really strong things I suggest to parents is having multiple, regular conversations with your kids, and being really, really open, because it's not say it once and be done, because our kids they will interpret what we think, what's their story in their head will be based on what they see us do and what they hear us say just in conversation. So if 90% of what we're talking to our kids about is school, that's where they come up with, my parents care more about my grades than me. And understandably so. It's not true, but it's understandable why they come up with that. So I think to have both parties come together and be like, this is stressful. And there are a lot of things to be worried about, but how are we going to navigate that? Can really, then you can operate from a place that's not fear-based and can be more practical, more measured, and more reasonable.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the things that I always say, I always tell people, friends, colleagues, clients, whatever, I truly do believe that communication is healthy. Communication is 90% of the solution to the majority of problems that we have as humans.
Absolutely. And
that's exactly what you're illustrating here. And I think a part of, you know, if I imagine myself as a parent listening to this and we think, okay, great, communication is a big part of the solution, but how do I communicate better? And one of the things that comes to my mind based off of what you said is really that concept of listening to hear rather than listening to formulate your next statement.
Yes, 100%.
And then also trying to actually like step out of your body, out of your looking behind your eyes and try to look through your child's eyes or the child trying to look through the parent's eyes to really see, try to see what the world looks like to them. Because like you were saying, the parent might be pushing their kid on different things and hyper-focusing on school because they're afraid the kid isn't going to get into these top level schools. But then if they actually got their child's perspective through a healthy dialogue, they might find out that their child doesn't even want to go to those schools. So now they're pushing them on something that isn't even on the child's radar for something they want to do. And how is that helping anybody when we're encouraging a goal that doesn't match up with what our kids want? And if our kids are afraid to talk to us because we're pushing so hard because we love them and we want what's best for them, we're never going to get to find out what it is they actually want because they're afraid to talk to us.
And it just usually doesn't end as well as it could. I mean, that's just right. A formula for a big mess by the time the child like wants to go off and maybe go to college. And so your point's so well taken about healthy communication, because the key is, like you said, we have to be empathetic. So we have to put ourselves in, you know, I have to get out of my 57-year-old head and get into, you know, my daughter's 18-year-old head and hear where she's coming from. And one of the hardest lessons for me as a parent, and I'm still learning it and practicing it, is not to problem solve. So a lot of times we listen to problem solve. So especially, you know, younger kid, they come home and, you know, somebody snubbed them in the cafeteria and they're feeling really yucky about it. And, you know, we come up with, well, you need to talk to a teacher, or did you do this? Or why don't you just do, and we just jump in with all the solutions and we miss the bigger picture of really connecting with our kid and showing them, wow, I heard that made you unhappy and sad and you felt bad and your feelings were hurt. And we keep, if we can listen that way, if we can kind of zip it with our agenda of like, let's just fix this for you. If we can zip it and listen and then reflect back, wow, I get what you're saying, and wait for that confirmation that yes, indeed you do get it. Actually probably 80-90% of the time, that's what our kids actually want from us when they come home and they just like dump all that onto us. And my youngest was a dumper. She'd come home and just, you know, kind of go off on all these things. And I'm a problem solver, so I jump in and give her all. And we got to the point where she just told me, I don't want you to solve the problem. I just want you to listen. And so once I really understood and listened that that's really what she wanted me to do, we have a thing where she reminds me now. So if I just kind of slip into my old habits of responding as being helpful, she just puts her hand up, you're doing it. And I'm like, oh, sorry. Okay. Continue. And that has worked out. That got us through high school, let me tell you. And our relationship became so much better. We became so much closer. And she tells me everything, more than I want to know, to be honest with you. But that's what came out of, you know, me being able to and do something very, very hard for me, because I'm a, you know, professional problem solver. It's what I do. So I have to really suppress that. And, you know, and I think it's really important for parents to realize no one is perfect at this. This is really hard. These are big asks, you know. Listen with empathy and don't try to help your kid, you know, let them help themselves. These are big asks, especially from the parenting culture we're coming through right now. But all we need to do is try. Mm-hmm. And we need to show our kids that we're trying, and we need to show up and make mistakes and say, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I didn't do it right that time. And I'm catching myself. Or if they call us out, to be apologetic. Because again, from a modeling standpoint, we're teaching them it's okay to make mistakes. Mm. And we can actually learn from our mistakes. And it's good to try. And our kids do not get enough of that messaging. They really don't.
No, they don't. I totally agree with you. They don't get that messaging typically in school, because mm-hmm. it is all about performance and results. And that permission to ask what sounds like a dumb question, but it's not dumb to you if you don't know the answer.
Right.
And to try an approach to solving a problem in school that is different and might fail. And who cares? At least you learned that that idea didn't work. Try the next one. I mean, that's what a scientist would do, right? And
right.
I think that this uber competitive performance-based culture that we've been bathing in for decades now really does squash out that innovation, that courage and willingness to try something new that might not work, to, you know, not conform to the traditional way of doing things. And I really do think, you know, when I hear myself saying that stuff out loud, what the human race needs as I look forward into the rest of this century, at least, is innovation, creativity, courage, curiosity. We need
flexibility, adaptability. Yeah. There's going to be uncertainty. Uncertainty is our future. I mean, it's baked in the cake at this point. And we are not churning out adaptable, flexible, curious, you know, want to learn kinds of kids. And that doesn't match the future that's waiting them.
Right. That's such a good point. Such a good point. I mean, we have big problems to solve.
We do. And our kids are perfectly capable of solving them, but they're not in the right mindset to do so.
Right. And we're not sculpting them. We're not molding them and building up those traits like you talked about that they will need to solve these big problems that are in the world today. Those Absolutely. Those traits like resilience and curiosity and just a passion to follow our curiosities or our interests or our questions and see where they take us, rather than worrying about, well, I'm really interested and curious about this, but it doesn't check any of these boxes over here with the SAT and the mm-hmm. college application and the APs and this and that and the other. What would the world look like if we just kind of crumpled that checklist up and threw it in the trash or the recycling bin?
Oh, if only. But it's more, you know, I think of it more like a cruise ship, trying to turn a cruise ship. You know, we can get there, but it is going to be slow, which is why I always suggest, you know, what is in our control is to kind of deal with it at our level, within our family, within our own schools, talking to teachers, asking what you need as a family. That is in our control. The larger picture that's driving all this, it's going to take a while. But I feel like more people are willing to, especially the pandemic kind of, you know, shown a spotlight on a lot of the issues that I think parents got a better understanding and feeling of what their kids are actually going through. I think prior to the pandemic, we thought school was like our school to a large extent. And I, you know, not understanding the intense pressure, the speed of the rigor, all those things, I think maybe were lost on us. And we thought our kids were just complaining, didn't like school. But I think we all now see, oh, there is something fundamentally not quite right here. And if we can all start talking about it, and we need the stakeholders, we need it to go bottom up, not top down. So right now, the culture is driven from, you know, corporate interests, political interests, to the colleges, which goes down to the high schools, which takes all the way down through education to the, you know, then the teacher, then the student, then the families. And it needs to be absolutely flipped on its head. So we need, you know, teachers know how to educate, and they're the last people to be asked. They get told, you need to try this program. You need to adhere to this policy. And they need to be the spokespeople. They need to be the experts at the table saying, no, this is what our children need. And this is how they learn best. And this is how we teach best. And if you start there with teachers, students, and parents and work your way up, then we're going to get to where we need to be.
That's such a good point. Such a good point. And the pandemic, I actually think, and I know that I'm eternally optimistic. Just, I have an unflappable optimism about things. And I really actually believe that as tough as things have been through this pandemic and all the big problems that are out in the world, I think humanity is ripe for transformation right now. And I think that because all of us could think of people we know personally, adults we know personally, adults we've heard of on interviews or seen on TV or what have you, read about in articles, who had a major awakening through this pandemic and completely changed their lives, whether they got on a health journey or whether they changed their career or whether they changed where they lived. You know, I don't need to commute to the office. I don't need to live in a city, in a concrete jungle. I can do my job just as well sitting on a beach somewhere, you know, whatever.
Right.
So many adults have had this awakening, like, what kind of a life was I living? I was unconsciously just going through the motions, getting up, clocking in, putting my time in, doing what's expected of me, blah, blah, blah. No passion, no zest for life. And then this pandemic comes and turns the whole world on its ear. And now adults are realizing, I was not living the life that is best for me. And if it's not the life that's best for me, then I'm not contributing what I'm supposed to contribute in the world. And so many adults have had this major awakening. It's a great time for us as parents to say, hey, we don't want to raise kids who are going to have to go through a major awakening like this. Let's help them now figure out what's right for them. Let's help them figure out what's passionate, what they're passionate about, what they're excited about. Maybe it doesn't mean they're going to be a doctor and they're going to go to Harvard, but it doesn't matter. Only the kids who want to do that should be doing that. If our kid wants to paint on canvas for their lifetime, then they should do that. If they want to create music or art or theater, or maybe they want to be a veterinarian, who knows what they want to do. But instead of us trying to fit them into a mold that some archaic society is expecting of them, why don't we bust up the mold and let them figure it out for themselves? And then we'll just stand there and support them and cheer them on and provide the resources that we can to help them. That's the soapbox I've been on.
I'm with you. I will join you on that soapbox 100%. 100%. And I think, oh my goodness, what a gift to our children. What a gift.
What a gift indeed. And I think that that's something that every human deserves, just by the fact that they have air in their lungs. And so when I say that, though, I can imagine a parent saying, great, so how do I do that? Mm-hmm. So what do you think are some tangible things that parents can do right now? Like easy, low-hanging fruit. I can accomplish this today when my kids get home from school. What can parents do to start embracing that kind of a spirit?
So a lot of our kids do have a passion, and you know, it's often not math or ELA
right,
or those kinds of things. So I think it should be a goal that we try not to squash that passion. And there's one thing that we do as parents that, again, well-intentioned, that has this unintended consequence of turning our kids off of their passions. And that is, like, say your child is a great artist. You know, they've been drawing pictures since, you know, first grade, and they're just getting better and better. They're doing amazing. And everybody says, oh my goodness, you're just an amazing artist. And there's an opportunity in elementary or middle or high school to enter their art into a contest. And you say, wow, you're so good. You need to enter this, or you need to enter your writing or your music or whatever their thing is. And what I often hear is kids will push back on that. They'll say, no, I don't want to. And if they're forced to do it, they then stop doing the thing. So they'll do it. But then after that, these kids can all hear parents come to me and they'll say, well, they used to, you know, draw all the time. They used to do competitions and blah, blah, blah. And they just don't have a passion for that anymore. And I talk to the students, and it's like, yeah, well, it wasn't fun once I had to do it for, again, a check the box kind of thing. So one of the goals should be keeping those passions alive, which means letting them be 100% in control of what they do. My daughter has been a proficient, my youngest, who's 18, she's been a proficient writer since little, since she could write. And she's written novels, all of them unfinished. You know, I mean, she's got 100,000 word novels. She doesn't finish them. She doesn't publish them. And she has, and it, in the past, when I've like said, would you want to do something with this? I get the whole, no, this is my stuff. And she would often do writing, like November is NaNoWriMo month, which is like a writer's time where they just churn out a ton of words on a project. And during November, when she's been a student, she doesn't do schoolwork. She basically writes. And I let her. I let her. Her grades, were they great during that? No, they were not. But I know she's a perfectly capable person. I know a C doesn't define who she is, if she's mm-hmm. going to end up with a C in this class. And she's bright enough that she gets by with not doing much work and still getting a B or C. So whatever. Her passion stayed alive. And I let her have, now she's in college doing English education.
I love it. And
loving it. So, I mean, I think that's, you know, just in service of what you just said, what you described, I think that's a, again, a great gift we can practically, you know, give our children on a day-to-day basis is, you know, cultivating their passions and not trying to be in charge of them.
You know, it's a question just came to my mind that I want to pose to my listeners. Do you know what your child is passionate about? That's a good question to ask yourself.
It's a good question, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine some parents immediately having an answer to that, and some parents maybe being a little unsettled because they don't actually know the answer to that question. And then the second question I would ask parents is, what are you passionate about? And you might get the same result. You might know immediately, and you might be unsettled because you don't have an answer. So I think that's probably an interesting thing to ponder for parents.
How are you, and how is a parent modeling that passion? Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, this is a great opportunity. If we as parents have a passion around gardening or reading or whatever it is, that we share that in a way that inspires our children to be passionate. And, you know, if there's a parent who's thinking, oh, my kid's passionate about video games. So that's not a passion that parents usually get behind and go, woohoo, they're going to be a professional video gamer. But, you know, I would still say there's probably, depending on the type of passion, there's something there. There's a path that passion for video games will actually play into other things, you know, yet unknown what they will be for your child. So, you know, within reason, allowing even something like that to be cultivated.
I have a nephew who is 21 now. He struggled in school. He was not your typical straight A student or even an AB student. And he tried the college route. Didn't really work for him. He's always been passionate about video games. And he has bounced around for a couple years, you know, this job, that job, the other one, trying to kind of figure stuff out. And earlier this year, he got a job offer to work in this new video game store, I guess you would call it, or a club or something that opened near us this year. And he works at the place. I don't know what to call it even. It doesn't sound right to call it a store, but he works at the place where kids and adults come and engage in video game tournaments. They play video games just, you know, you can just show up and play there if you want with your friends or whatever, but they also host tournaments there. And so my nephew works there full time. He runs the tournaments. He plays in the tournaments. He just flew to a different state to play in a tournament representing this company. And he is as happy as I've ever seen him. And he's excited to go to work every day. And he's winning some of these tournaments. He's doing well. He's making a reputation and a name for himself. And if his parents had squashed or tried to suffocate his love of video games and try to force him into some other direction that didn't fit for him, where would he be now?
Exactly.
And I think he's just such a great example of a kid who is finding his way, particularly in a field where parents want to push their kids away from it.
Right. And he is successful.
Yes.
That's the key.
And
he is happy. Yes. And isn't this what we want for our kids? Now, maybe that's not the one of the check the box, like career paths that parents have in mind, but that's the problem. We shouldn't be picking and choosing or limiting those career paths for our kids, because they're unique individuals who will be happiest and have the greatest life satisfaction and greater mental health if they can forge their path ahead.
Yes.
That's true and authentic to them. And we get to witness the joy that comes out of that in the long run. And it won't be easy. I will never say, you know, just let go and let it happen and, you know, everything will be fine. It will be hard and there will be lots and lots of challenges, but we have to trust in our kids most of all and trust the process, because that's the human desire. It's what we're here to do. We're here to become who we need to be. And if we're pushed off that track, you know, then I think we see more of the mental health issues and life to change when a pandemic happens and retire early or do whatever.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point, and I think that's a great point for us to wrap it up on. Trust our kids and trust the process. And then if you're struggling, reach out to someone who can remind you to trust your kids and trust the process. So thank you so much, Janine, Dr. Janine Argeno, for joining me today in this wonderful conversation. I think we brought a lot of value to parents. Where can parents find you if they would like to connect with you and learn more about what you do and get your book and all that kind of stuff?
So everything about me is on my website, which is JanineGeno.com. I have a monthly newsletter, which is just some thoughts. So I just basically whatever I've been thinking about from the last month, I put in my newsletter. My social media links are there, and all the information about my book and coaching is there as well. So I'd love to connect with people.
Awesome. I will put your website in the show notes as well, so people can find it there too.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. I enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, this was a lovely discussion. I really enjoyed it, and we'll have to have a part two sometime.
Once. I feel optimistic.
Yay!
Which is nice. Thank
That's
you.
Awesome. I am so glad to hear that. And I hope everyone listening to our chat also feels similarly optimistic, because there's much to be optimistic about, even Absolutely. Though there are tons of issues that we have to solve as well. So thank you very much for this conversation. I really enjoyed it. And that wraps up today's episode. Wherever you are in this world, I hope that you make it a very enlightened and curious day for yourself. That wraps up this episode of Powerful Parenting for Today's Kids. If you know anyone who could benefit from this episode or this podcast in general, please share it with them. Also, I always love hearing feedback from my listeners. I welcome you to send me an email to erin@erin-taylor.com if you have any comments or questions that come up for you in an episode. Our children are our future. Parenting them is the most sacred task we will ever be asked to do. It truly does take a village to raise a child. Let's help each other to raise our children to be who it is they are meant to be. If at any point you feel like you need a little extra help and support, reach out to me. I am here to help you.